This is Audible.
Time Warner Audiobooks presents Me Talk Pretty One Day, written by David Sedaris and read by the author.
Go Carolina. Anyone who watches even the slightest amount of TV is familiar with the scene. An agent knocks on the door of some seemingly ordinary home or office. The door opens, and the person holding the knob is asked to identify himself. The agent then says, "I'm going to have to ask you to come with me." They're always remarkably calm, these agents. If asked, "Why do I need to go anywhere with you?" they'll straighten their shirt cuffs or idly brush stray hairs from the sleeves of their sports coats, saying, "Oh, I think we both know why." The suspect then chooses between doing things the hard way and doing things the easy way. And the scene ends with either gunfire or the gentlemanly application of handcuffs. Occasionally it's a case of mistaken identity, but most often the suspect knows exactly why he's being taken. It seems he's been expecting this to happen. The anticipation has ruled his life, and now, finally, the wait is over. You're sometimes led to believe that this person is actually relieved, but I've never bought it. Though it probably has its moments, the average day spent in hiding is bound to beat the average day spent in prison. When it comes time to decide who gets the bottom bunk, I think anyone would agree that there's a lot to be said for doing things the hard way. The agent came for me during a geography lesson. She entered the room and nodded at my fifth grade teacher, who stood frowning at a map of Europe. What would needle me later was the realization that this had all been prearranged. My capture had been scheduled to go down at exactly 2:30 on a Thursday afternoon. The agent would be wearing a dung-colored blazer over a red knit turtleneck, her heels sensibly low in case the suspect should attempt a quick getaway. "David," the teacher said, "this is Miss Sampson, and she'd like you to go with her now." No one else had been called, so why me? I ran down a list of recent crimes, looking for a conviction that might stick. Setting fire to a reportedly flame-proof Halloween costume. Stealing a set of barbecue tongs from an unguarded patio. Altering the word "hit" on a list of rules posted on the gymnasium door. Never did it occur to me that I might be innocent. "You might want to take your books with you," the teacher said. "And your jacket. You probably won't be back before the bell rings." Though she seemed old at the time, the agent was most likely fresh out of college. She walked beside me and asked what appeared to be an innocent and unrelated question. "So which do you like better, State or Carolina?" She was referring to the athletic rivalry between the Triangle area's two largest universities. Those who cared about such things tended to express their allegiance by wearing either Tar Heel powder blue or Wolfpack red, two colors that managed to look good on no one. The question of team preference was common in our part of North Carolina, and the answer supposedly spoke volumes about the kind of person you either were or hoped to become. I had no interest in football or basketball, but had learned it was best to pretend otherwise. If a boy didn't care for barbecued chicken or potato chips, people would accept it as a matter of personal taste, saying, "Oh well, I guess it takes all kinds." You could turn up your nose at the president, or Coke, or even God, but there were names for boys who didn't like sports. When the subject came up, I found it best to ask which team my questioner preferred. Then I'd say, "Really? Me too." Asked by the agent which team I supported, I took my cue from her red turtleneck and told her that I was for State. Definitely State. State all the way. It was an answer I would regret for years to come. "State, did you say?" the agent asked. "Yeah, State. They're the greatest." "I see." She led me through an unmarked door near the principal's office, into a small, windowless room furnished with two facing desks. It was the kind of room where you'd grill someone until they snapped, the kind frequently painted as to cover the bloodstains. She gestured toward what was to become my regular seat, then continued her line of questioning. "And what exactly are they, State and Carolina? Colleges? Universities?" She opened a file on her desk, saying, "Yes, you're right. Your answers are correct, but you're saying them incorrectly. You're telling me that they're colleges and universities, when actually they're colleges and universities. You're giving me a th sound instead of a nice clear S. Can you hear the distinction between those two different sounds?" I nodded. "May I please have an actual answer?" "Uh-huh." "Uh-huh is not a word." "Okay." "Okay what?" "Okay," I said. "Sure, I can hear it." "You can hear what? The distinction? The contrast?" "Yeah, that." It was the first battle of my war against the letter S, and I was determined to dig my foxhole before the sun went down. According to Agent Sampson, a state-certified speech therapist, my S was sibilant, meaning that I lisped. This was not news to me. "Our goal is to work together until eventually you can speak correctly," Agent Sampson said. She made a great show of enunciating her own sparkling S's, and the effect was profoundly irritating. "I'm trying to help you, but the longer you play these little games, the longer this is going to take." The woman spoke with a heavy Western North Carolina accent, which I used to discredit her authority. Here was a person for whom the word pen had two syllables. Her people undoubtedly drank from clay jugs and hollered for paw when the victuals was ready. So who was she to advise me on anything? Over the coming years, I would find a crack in each of the therapists sent to train what Miss Sampson now defined as my lazy tongue. "That's its problem," she said. "It's just plain lazy." My sisters Amy and Gretchen were at the time undergoing therapy for their lazy eyes, while my older sister Lisa had been born with a lazy leg that had refused to grow at the same rate as its twin. She'd worn a corrective brace for the first 2 years of her life, and wherever she roamed, she'd left a trail of scratch marks in the soft pine floor. I liked the idea that part of one's body might be thought of as lazy, not thoughtless or hostile, just unwilling to extend itself for the betterment of the team. My father often accused my mother of having a lazy mind, while she, in turn, accused him of having a lazy index finger, unable to dial the phone when he knew damn well he was going to be late. My therapy sessions were scheduled for every Thursday at 2:30, and with the exception of my mother, I discussed them with no one. The word therapy suggested a profound failure on my part. Mental patients had therapy. Normal people did not. I didn't see my sessions as the sort of thing that one would want to advertise, but as my teacher liked to say, "I guess it takes all kinds." Whereas my goal was to keep it a secret, hers was to inform the entire class. If I got up from my seat at 2:25, she'd say, "Sit back down, David. You've still got 5 minutes before your speech therapy session." If I remained seated until 2:27, she'd say, "David, don't forget you have a speech therapy session at 2:30. On the days I was absent, I imagined she addressed the room saying, "David's not here today, but if he were, he'd have a speech therapy session at 2:30. My sessions varied from week to week. Sometimes I'd spend the half hour parroting whatever Agent Sampson had to say. We'd occasionally pass the time examining charts on tongue position or reading childish, S-laden texts recounting the adventures of seals or settlers named Sassy or Samuel. On the worst of days, she'd haul out a tape recorder and show me just how much progress I was failing to make. "My speech therapist's name is Miss Chrissy Sampson." She'd hand me the microphone and lean back with her arms crossed. "Go ahead, say it. I want you to hear what you sound like." She was in love with the sound of her own name and seemed to view my speech impediment as a personal assault. If I wanted to spend my life as David Sedareth, then so be it. She, however, was going to be called Miss Chrissy Sampson. Had her name included no S's, she probably would have bypassed a career in therapy and devoted herself to yanking out healthy molars or performing unwanted clitoridectomies on the schoolgirls of Africa. Such was her personality. "Oh, come on," my mother said. "I'm sure she's not that bad. Give her a break. The girl's just trying to do her job." I was a few minutes early one week and entered the office to find Agent Sampson doing her job to Garth Barkley, a slight kittenish boy I'd met back in the fourth grade. "You may wait outside in the hall until it is your turn," she told me. A week or two later, my session was interrupted by mincing Steve Bixler, who popped his head in the door and announced that his parents were taking him out of town for a long weekend, meaning that he would miss his regular Friday session. "Sorry about that," he said. I started keeping watch over the speech therapy door, taking note of who came and went. Had I seen one popular student leaving the office, I could have believed my mother and viewed my lisp as the sort of thing that might happen to anyone. Unfortunately, I saw no popular students. Chuck Coggins, Sam Shelton, Louis DeLuca. Obviously, there was some connection between a sibilant S and a complete lack of interest in the state versus Carolina issue. None of the therapy students were girls. They were all boys like me who kept movie star scrapbooks and made their own curtains. "You don't want to be doing that," the men in our families would say. "That's a girl thing." Baking scones and cupcakes for the school janitors, watching Guiding Light with our mothers, collecting rose petals for use in fragrant potpourri. Anything worth doing turned out to be a girl thing. In order to enjoy ourselves, we learned to be duplicitous. Our stacks of Cosmopolitan were topped with an unread issue of Boy's Life or Sports Illustrated, and our decoupage projects were concealed beneath the sporting equipment we never asked for, but always received. When asked what we wanted to be when we grew up, we hid the truth and listed who we wanted to sleep with when we grew up. A policeman or a fireman or one of those guys who works with high-tension wires. Symptoms were feigned, and our mothers wrote notes excusing our absences on the day of the intramural softball tournament. Brian had a stomach virus, or Ted suffered from that 24-hour bug that seemed to be going around. "One of these days, I'm going to hang a sign on that door," Agent Sampson used to say. She was probably thinking along the lines of speech therapy lab, though a more appropriate marker would have read, "Future Homosexuals of America." We knocked ourselves out trying to fit in, but were ultimately betrayed by our tongues. At the beginning of the school year, while we were congratulating ourselves on successfully passing for normal, Agent Sampson was taking names as our assembled teachers raised their hands, saying, "I've got one in my home room," and, "There are two in my fourth period math class." Were they also able to spot the future drunks and depressives? Did they hope that by eliminating our lisps they might set us on a different path, or were they trying to prepare us for future stage and choral careers? Miss Sampson instructed me when forming an S to position the tip of my tongue against the rear of my top teeth, right up against the gum line. The effect produced a sound not unlike that of a tire releasing air. It was awkward and strange-sounding and elicited much more attention than the original lisp. I failed to see the hissy S as a solution to the problem and continued to talk normally, at least at home where my lazy tongue fell upon equally lazy ears. At school, where every teacher was a potential spy, I tried to avoid an S sound whenever possible. Yes became correct or a military affirmative. Please became with your kind permission, and questions were pleaded rather than asked. After a few weeks of what she called endless pestering and what I called repeated badgering, my mother bought me a pocket thesaurus, which provided me with S-free alternatives to just about everything. I consulted the book both at home in my room and at the Daily Learning Academy other people called our school. Agent Sampson was not amused when I began referring to her as an articulation coach, but the majority of my teachers were delighted. "What a nice vocabulary," they said. "My goodness, such big words." Plurals presented a considerable problem, but I worked around them as best I could. Rivers, for example, became either a river or two or many a river. Possessives were a similar headache, and it was easier to say nothing than to announce that the left hand and the right hand glove of Janet had fallen to the floor. After all the compliments I had received on my improved vocabulary, it seemed prudent to lie low and keep my mouth shut. I didn't want anyone thinking I was trying to be a pet of the teacher. When I first began my speech therapy, I worried that the Agent Sampson plan might work for everyone but me, that the other boys might strengthen their lazy tongues, turn their lives around, and leave me stranded. Luckily, my fears were never realized. Despite the woman's best efforts, no one seemed to make any significant improvement. The only difference was that we were all a little quieter. Thanks to Agent Sampson's tape recorder, I, along with the others, now had a clear sense of what I actually sounded like. There was a lisp, of course, but much more troubling was my voice itself with its excitable tone and high, girlish pitch. I'd hear myself ordering lunch in the cafeteria, and the sound would turn my stomach. How could anyone stand to listen to me? Whereas those around me might grow up to be lawyers or movie stars, my only option was to take a vow of silence and become a monk. My former classmates would call the Abbey, wondering how I was doing, and the priest would answer the phone. "You can't talk to him," he'd say. "Why, Brother David hasn't spoken to anyone in 35 years. "Oh, relax," my mother said. "Your voice will change eventually."
"And what if it doesn't?"
She shuddered. "Don't be so morbid." It turned out that Agent Sampson was something along the lines of a circuit court speech therapist. She spent 4 months at our school and then moved on to another. Our last meeting was held the day before school let out for Christmas. My classrooms were all decorated, the halls, everything but her office, which remained as bare as ever. I was expecting a regular half hour of Sassy the Seal and was delighted to find her packing up her tape recorder.
"I thought this afternoon we might let loose and have a party, you and I. How does that sound?"
She reached into her desk drawer and withdrew a festive tin of cookies.
"Here, have one. I made them myself from scratch, and boy, was it a mess. Did you ever make cookies?"
I lied, saying that no, I never had.
"Well, it's hard work," she said, "especially if you don't have a mixer."
It was unlike Agent Sampson to speak so casually, and awkward to sit in the hot little room pretending to have a normal conversation.
"So," she said, "what are your plans for the holidays?"
"Well, I usually remain here and, you know, open a gift from my family."
"Only one?" she asked.
"Maybe 8 or 10.
"Never 6 or 7?
"Rarely," I said.
"And what do you do on December 31st, New Year's Eve?"
"On the final day of the year, we take down the pine tree in our living room and eat marine life."
"You're pretty good at avoiding those S's," she said. "I have to hand it to you, you're tougher than most."
I thought she would continue trying to trip me up, but instead she talked about her own holiday plans.
"It's pretty hard with my fiancé in Vietnam," she said. "Last year we went to see his folks in Roanoke, but this year I'll spend Christmas with my grandmother outside of Asheville. My parents will come, and we'll all try our best to have a good time. I'll eat some turkey and go to church. And then, the next day, a friend and I will drive down to Jacksonville to watch Florida play Tennessee in the Gator Bowl."
I couldn't imagine anything worse than driving down to Florida to watch a football game, but I pretended to be impressed.
"Wow," I said. "That ought to be eventful." "I was in Memphis last year when NC State whooped Georgia 14-7 in the Liberty Bowl," she said. "And next year, I don't care who's playing, but I want to be sitting front row center at the Tangerine Bowl. Have you ever been to Orlando? It is a super fun place. If my future husband can find a job in his field, we're hoping to move down there within a year or two. Me living in Florida. I bet that would make you happy, wouldn't it?"
I didn't quite know how to respond. Who was this college bowl fanatic with no mixer and a fiancé in Vietnam? And why had she taken so long to reveal herself? Here I thought of her as a cold-blooded agent, when she was really nothing but a slightly dopey, inexperienced speech teacher. She wasn't a bad person, Miss Sampson, but her timing was off. She should have acted friendly at the beginning of the year instead of waiting until now, when all I could do was feel sorry for her. I tried my best to work with you and the others, but sometimes a person's best just isn't good enough. She took another cookie and turned it over in her hands. I really wanted to prove myself and make a difference in people's lives, but it's so hard to do your job when you're met with so much resistance. My students don't like me, and I guess that's just the way it is. What can I say? As a speech teacher, I'm a complete failure. She moved her hands toward her face, and I worried that she might start to cry. "Hey, look," I said. "I'm sorry." "Ha," she said. "Got you." She laughed much more than she needed to, and was still at it when she signed the form recommending me for the following year's speech therapy program. "Sorry, indeed. You got some work ahead of you, mister." I related the story to my mother, who got a huge kick out of it. "You've got to admit that you really are a sucker," she said. I agreed, but because none of my speech classes ever made a difference, I still prefer to use the word chump. Giant dreams, midget abilities. My father loves jazz and has an extensive collection of records and reel-to-reel tapes he used to listen to after returning home from work. He might have entered the house in a foul mood, but once he had his Dexter Gordon and a vodka martini, the stress melted away and everything was beautiful, baby, just beautiful. The instant the needle hit that record, he'd loosen his tie and become something other than the conservative engineer with a pocket full of IBM pencils embossed with the command, "Think."
"Man, oh man, will you get a load of the chops on that guy? I saw him once at the Blue Note, and I mean to tell you that he blew me right out of my chair. A talent like that comes around once in a lifetime. The guy was an absolute comet, and there I was on the front row. Can you imagine that?"
"Gee," I'd say. "I bet that was really something." Empathy was the wrong tack, as it only seemed to irritate him.
"You don't know the half of it," he'd say. "Really something, my butt. You haven't got a clue. You could have taken a hatchet and cut the man's lips right off his face. Chopped him off at the quick, and he still would have played better than anyone else out there. That's how good he was."
I'd nod my head, envisioning a pair of glistening lips lying forsaken on the floor of some nightclub dressing room. The trick was to back slowly towards a hallway, escaping into the kitchen before my father could yell, "Oh, no, you don't. Get back in here. I want you to sit down for a minute and listen. I mean, really listen to this next number." Because it was the music we'd grown up with, I liked to think that my sisters and I had a genuine appreciation for jazz. We preferred it over the music our friends were listening to, yet nothing we did or said could convince our father of our devotion. Aside from replaying the tune on your own instrument, how could you prove you were really listening? It was as if he expected us to change color at the end of each selection. Due to his ear and almost maniacal sense of discipline, I always thought my father would have made an excellent musician. He might have studied the saxophone had he not been born to immigrant parents who considered even potholders an extravagance. They themselves listened only to Greek music, an oxymoron as far as the rest of the world is concerned. Slam its tail in the door of a milk truck, and a stray cat could easily yowl out a single ascertain to top the charts back in Sparta or Thessaloniki. Jazz was my father's only form of rebellion. It was forbidden in his home, and he appreciated it as though it were his own private discovery. As a young man, he hid his 78s under the sofa bed and regularly snuck off to New York City, where he'd haunt the clubs and consort with Negroes. It was a good life while it lasted. He was in his early 40s when the company transferred our family to North Carolina.
"You expect me to live where?" he'd asked.
The Raleigh winters agreed with him, but he would have gladly traded the temperate climate for a decent radio station. Since he was limited to his record and tape collection, it became his dream that his family might fill the musical void by someday forming a jazz combo. His plan took shape the evening he escorted my sisters Lisa and Gretchen and me to the local state university to see Dave Brubeck, who was then touring with his sons. The audience roared when the quartet took the stage, and I leaned back and shut my eyes, pretending the applause was for me. In order to get that kind of attention, you needed a routine that would knock people's socks off. I'd been working on something in private, and now began to imagine bringing it to a live audience. The act consisted of me, dressed in a nice shirt and tie, and singing a medley of commercial jingles in the voice of Billie Holiday, who was one of my father's favorite singers. For my Raleigh concert, I'd probably open with the number used to promote the town's oldest shopping center. A quick nod to my accompanist, and I'd launch into
"The Excitement of Cameron Village Will Carry You Away."
The beauty of my rendition was that it captured both the joy and the sorrow of a visit to Ellisburg's or JCPenney's. This would be followed by such crowd-pleasers as "Winston Tastes Good Like a Cigarette Should" and the catchy new Coke commercial, "I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing." I was lost in my fantasy, ignoring Dave Brubeck and coming up for air only when my father elbowed my ribs to ask, "Are you listening to this? These cats are burning the paint right off the walls." The other audience members sat calmly, as if in church, while my father snapped his fingers and bobbed his head low against his chest. People pointed, and when we begged him to sit up and act normal, he cupped his hands to his mouth and shouted out a request for "Blue Rondo a la Turk." Driving home from the concert that night, he drummed his palms against the steering wheel, saying, "Did you hear that? That guy just gets better every day. He's up there on stage with his kids by his side, the whole lot of them jamming up a storm. Christ almighty, what I wouldn't give for a family like that. You guys should think about putting an act together." My sister Lisa coughed up a mouthful of grapefruit soda. "No, I mean it," my father said. "All you need are some lessons and instruments, and I swear to God you'd go right through the roof." We hoped this was just another of his five-minute ideas, but by the time we reached the house, his eyes were still glowing. "That's exactly what you need to do," he said. "I don't know why I didn't think of it sooner." The following afternoon, he bought a baby grand piano. It was a used model that managed to look imposing, even when positioned on a linoleum-tiled floor. We took turns stabbing at the keys, but as soon as the novelty wore off, we bolstered it with sofa cushions and turned it into a fort. The piano sat neglected in the traditional sense until my father signed up Gretchen for a series of lessons. She'd never expressed any great interest in the thing, but was chosen because, at the age of 10, she possessed what our dad decided were the most artistic fingers. Lisa was assigned the flute, and I returned home from a scout meeting one evening to find my instrument leaning against the aquarium in my bedroom. "Hold on to your hat," my father said, "because here's that guitar you always wanted." Surely he had me confused with someone else. While I had regularly petitioned for a brand-name vacuum cleaner, I'd never said anything about wanting a guitar. Nothing about it appealed to me, not even on an aesthetic level. I had my room arranged just so, and the instrument did not fit in with my nautical theme. An anchor, yes. A guitar, no. He wanted me to jam, so I jammed it into my closet, where it remained until he signed me up for some private lessons, offered at a music shop located on the ground floor of the recently opened North Hills Mall. I fought it as best I could, and feigned illness even as he dropped me off from my first appointment. "But I'm sick," I yelled, watching him pull out of the parking lot. "I have a virus, and besides that, I don't want to play a musical instrument. Don't you know anything?" When it finally sank in that he wasn't coming back, I lugged my guitar into the music store, where the manager led me to my teacher, a perfectly formed midget named Mr. Mancini. I was 12 years old at the time, small for my age, and it was startling to find myself locked in a windowless room with a man who barely reached my chest. It seemed wrong that I would be taller than my teacher, but I kept this to myself, saying only, "My father told me to come here. It was all his idea." A fastidious dresser stuck in a small, unfashionable town. Mr. Mancini wore clothing I recognized from the young squire's department of Hudson Belk. Some nights he favored button-down shirts with clip-on ties, while other evenings I arrived to find him dressed in flared slacks and snug turtleneck sweaters, a swag of love beads hanging from his neck. His arms were manly and covered in coarse, dark hair, but his voice was high and strange, as if it had been recorded and was now being played back at a faster speed. Not a dwarf, but an honest-to-God midget. My fascination was both evident and unwelcome, and was nothing he hadn't been subjected to a million times before. He didn't shake my hand, just lit a cigarette and reached for the conch shell he used as an ashtray. Like my father, Mr. Mancini assumed that anyone could learn to play the guitar. He had picked it up during a single summer spent in what he called Hotlanta, G.A. This, I knew, was a racy name given to Atlanta, Georgia. "Now that," he said, "is one classy place if you know where to go." He picked my guitar up and began tuning it, holding his head close to the strings. "Yes, sirree, kids, the girls down on Peachtree are running wild 24 hours a day." He mentioned a woman named Beth, saying, "They threw away the mold and shut down the factory after making that one, you know what I mean?" I nodded my head, having no idea what he was talking about. "She wasn't much of a cook, but hey, I guess that's why God invented TV dinners." He laughed at his little joke and repeated the line about frozen dinners, as if he would use it later in a comedy routine. "God made TV dinners. Yeah, that's good." He told me he'd named his guitar after Beth. "Now I can't keep my hands off her," he said. "Seriously, though, it helps if you give your instrument a name. What do you think you'll call yours?" "Maybe I'll call it Oliver," I said. That was the name of my hamster, and I was used to saying it. Then again, maybe not. "Oliver?" Mr. Mancini set my guitar on the floor. "Oliver? What the hell kind of a name is that? If you're going to devote yourself to the guitar, you need to name it after a girl, not a guy." "Oh, right," I said. "Joan. I'll call it Joan."
"So tell me about this Joan," he said. "Is she something pretty special?"
Joan was the name of one of my cousins, but it seemed unwise to share this information. "Oh, yeah," I said. "Joan's really great. She's tall and..." I felt self-conscious using the word tall and struggled to take it back. "She's small and has brown hair and everything."
"Is she stacked?"
I'd never noticed my cousin's breasts, and had lately realized that I'd never noticed anyone's breasts, not unless, like our housekeepers, they were large enough to appear freakish. "Stacked? Well, sure," I said. "She's pretty stacked." I was afraid he'd ask me for a more detailed description, and was relieved when he crossed the room and removed Beth from her case. He told me that a guitar student needed plenty of discipline. Talent was great, but time had taught him that talent was also extremely rare.
"I've got it," he said. "But then again, I was born with it. It's a gift from God, and those of us who have it are very special people."
He seemed to know that I was nothing special but just a type, yet another boy whose father had his head in the clouds.
"Do you have a feel for the guitar? Do you have any idea what this little baby is capable of?"
Without waiting for an answer, he climbed up into his chair and began playing Light My Fire, adding,
"This one is for Joan."
"You know that I would be untrue," he sang. "You know that I would be a liar." The current hit version of the song was performed by Jose Feliciano, a blind man whose plaintive voice served the lyrics much better than did Jim Morrison, who sang it in what I considered to be a bossy and conceited tone of voice. There was Jose Feliciano, there was Jim Morrison, and then there was Mr. Mancini, who played beautifully, but sang Light My Fire as if he were a Weeblo scout searching for a match. He finished his opening number, nodded his head in acknowledgement of my applause, and moved on, offering up his own unique and unsettling versions of The Girl from Ipanema and Little Green Apples, while I sat trapped in my seat, my false smile stretched so tight that I lost all feeling in the lower half of my face. My fingernails had grown a good 3 inches by the time he struck his final note and called me close to point out a few simple chords. Before I left, he handed me a half dozen purple mimeographed handouts, which we both knew were useless. Back at the house, my mother had my dinner warming in the oven. From the living room came the aimless whisper of Lisa's flute. It sounded not unlike the wind whipping through an empty Pepsi can. Down in the basement, either Gretchen was practicing her piano, or the cat was chasing a moth across the keys. My mother responded by turning up the volume on the kitchen TV, while my father pushed back my plate, set Joan in my lap, and instructed me to play.
"Listen to this," he crowed. "A house full of music, man, this is beautiful."
You certainly couldn't accuse him of being unsupportive. His enthusiasm bordered on mania, but still it failed to inspire us. During practice sessions, my sisters and I would eat potato chips, scowling at our hated instruments and speculating on the lives of our music teachers. They were all peculiar in one way or another, but with a midget, I definitely won the "my teacher is stranger than yours" competition. I wondered where Mr. Mancini lived and who he might call in case of an emergency. Did he stand on a chair in order to shave, or was his home customized to meet his needs? I'd look at the laundry hamper or beer cooler, thinking that if it came down to it, Mr. Mancini could hide just about anywhere. Though I thought of him constantly, I grabbed any excuse to avoid my guitar. "I've been doing just what you told me to do," I'd say at the beginning of each lesson, "but I just can't seem to get the hang of it. Maybe my fingers are too short, but little, maybe I'm just not coordinated enough." He'd arrange Joan in my lap, pick up Beth, and tell me to follow along.
"You need to believe you're playing an actual woman," he'd say. "Just grab her by the neck and make her holler."
Mr. Mancini had a singular talent for making me uncomfortable. He forced me to consider things I'd rather not think about. The sex of my guitar, for instance. If I honestly wanted to put my hands on a woman, would that automatically mean I could play? Gretchen's teacher never told her to think of her piano as a boy. Neither did Lisa's flute teacher, though in that case the analogy was fairly obvious. On the off chance that sexual desire was all it took, I steered clear of Lisa's instrument, fearing I might be labeled a prodigy. The best solution was to become a singer and leave the instruments to other people. A song stylist. That was what I wanted to be. I was at the mall with my mother one afternoon when I spotted Mr. Mancini reaching up to order a hamburger at Scotty's Chuckwagon, a fast food restaurant located a few doors down from the music shop. He sometimes mentioned having lunch with a salesgirl from Jolly's Jewelers, but on this day he was alone. Mr. Mancini had to stand on his tiptoes to ask for his hamburger, and even then his head failed to reach the counter. The passing adults politely looked away, but their children were decidedly more vocal. A toddler ambled up on his chubby bowed legs, attempting to embrace my teacher with ketchup-smeared fingers, while a party of elementary school students openly stared in wonder. Even worse was a group of adolescents, boys my age, who sat gathered around a large table. "Go back to Oz, Munchkin," one of them said, and his friends shook with laughter. Tray in hand, Mr. Mancini took a seat and pretended not to notice. The boys weren't yelling, but anyone could tell that they were making fun of him. "Honestly, Mother," I said, "do they have to be such monsters?" Beneath my moral outrage was a strong sense of possessiveness, a fury that other people were sinking their hooks into my own personal midget. What did they know about this man? I was the one who lit his cigarettes and listened as he denounced the careers of so-called pretty boys such as Glenn Campbell and Bobby Goldsboro. It was I who had suffered through 6 weeks of lessons and was still struggling to master Yellow Bird. If anyone was going to give him a hard time, I figured that I should be the first in line. I'd always thought of Mr. Mancini as a blowhard, a pocket playboy, but watching him dip his hamburger into a sad puddle of mayonnaise, I broadened my view and came to see him as a wee outsider, a misfit whose take-it-or-leave-it attitude had left him all alone. This was a persona I'd been tinkering with myself. The outcast, the rebel. It occurred to me that with the exception of the guitar, he and I actually had quite a bit in common. We were each men trapped inside a boy's body. Each of us was talented in his own way, and we both hated 12-year-old males, a demographic group second to none in terms of cruelty. All things considered, there was no reason I shouldn't address him not as a teacher, but as an artistic brother. Maybe then we could drop the pretense of Joan and get down to work. If things worked out the way I hoped, I'd someday mention in interviews that my accompanist was both my best friend and a midget. I wore a tie to my next lesson, and this time, when asked if I'd practiced, I told the truth, saying in a matter-of-fact tone of voice that no, I hadn't laid a finger on my guitar since our last get-together. I told him that Joan was my cousin's name, and that I had no idea how stacked she was.
"That's okay," Mr. Mancini said. "You can call your guitar whatever you want, just so long as you practice."
My voice shaking, I told him that I had absolutely no interest in mastering the guitar. What I really wanted to do was to sing in the voice of Billie Holiday. Mainly commercials, but not for any banks, because those are usually choral arrangements. The color ebbed from my teacher's face. I told him that I'd been working up an act and could use a little accompaniment. Did he know the jingle for the new Sara Lee campaign?
"You want me to do what?"
He wasn't angry, just confused. I felt certain he was lying when he denied knowing the tune. Double Mint Gum, Ritz Crackers, the theme songs for Alka-Seltzer and Kenmore Appliances. He claimed ignorance on all counts. I knew that it was queer to sing in front of someone, but greater than my discomfort was the hope that he might recognize what I thought of as my only talent, the one musical trick I was able to pull off. I started in on an a cappella version of the latest Sir Walter Chevrolet commercial, hoping he might join in once the spirit moved him. It looked bad, I knew, but in order to sustain the proper mood, I needed to disregard his company and sing the way I did at home in my bedroom, my eyes shut tight and my hands dangling like pointless, empty gloves.
"Let's go Chevy shopping, deals are hopping, Sir Walter Chevrolet. We've got higher trade-ins, lower prices, Sir Walter Chevrolet."
I reached the end of my tune thinking he might take this as an opportunity to applaud or maybe even apologize for underestimating me. Mild amusement would have been an acceptable response, but instead he held up his hands as if to stop an advancing car.
"Hey, guy," he said, "you can hold it right there. I'm not into that scene."
A scene? What scene? I thought I was being original.
"There were plenty of screwballs like you back in Atlanta, but me, I don't swing that way. You got it? That might be your thing or whatever, but you can definitely count me out."
He reached for his conch shell and stubbed out his cigarette.
"I mean, come on now. For God's sake, kid, pull yourself together."
I knew then why I'd never before sung in front of anyone, and why I shouldn't have done it in front of Mr. Mancini. He'd used the word screwball, but I knew what he really meant. He meant I should have named my guitar Doug or Brian or, better yet, taken up the flute. He meant that if we're defined by our desires, then I was in for a lifetime of trouble. The remainder of the hour was spent awkwardly watching the clock as we silently pretended to tune our guitars. My father was disappointed when I told him I wouldn't be returning for any more lessons. "He told me not to come back," I said. "He told me I have the wrong kind of fingers." Seeing that it had worked for me, my sisters invented similar stories, and together we announced that the Sedaris Trio had officially disbanded. Our father offered to find us better teachers, adding that if we were unhappy with our instruments, we could trade them in for something more suitable.
"The trumpeter, the saxophoner, hey, how about the vibes?"
He reached for a Lionel Hampton album, saying,
"I want you to sit down and give this a good listen. Just get a load of this cat and tell me he's not an inspiration."
There was a time when I could listen to such a record and imagine myself as a headline act at some magnificent New York nightclub, but that's what fantasies are for. They allow you to skip the degradation and head straight to the top. I'd done my solo and would now move on to pursue other equally unsuccessful ways of getting attention. I'd try every art form there was, and with each disappointment, I'd picture Mr. Mancini holding his conch shell and saying, "For God's sakes, kid, pull yourself together." We told our father, "No, don't bother playing us any more of your records," but still he persisted. "I'm telling you that this album is going to change your life, and if it doesn't, I'll give each one of you a $5 bill. What do you think about that?" It was a tough call, $5 for listening to a Lionel Hampton record. The offer was tempting, but even on the off chance that he'd actually come through with the money, there would certainly be strings attached. We looked at one another, my sisters and I, and then we left the room, ignoring his cry of, "Hey, where do you think you're going? Get back in here and listen." We joined our mother at the TV and never looked back. A life in music was his great passion, not ours, and our lessons had taught us that without that passion, the best one could hope for was an occasional engagement at some hippie wedding, where if we were lucky, the guests would be too stoned to realize just how bad we really were. That night, as was his habit, our father fell asleep in front of the stereo, the record making its pointless silent rounds as he laid back against the sofa cushions, dreaming.
Ladies and gentlemen, David Sedaris.
This story is called The Youth in Asia. In the early 1960s, during what my mother referred to as the tail end of the Lassie years, my parents were given two collies, which they named Rastus and Duchess. We were living then in New York State, out in the country, and the dogs were free to race through the forest. They napped in meadows and stood knee-deep in frigid streams, co-stars in their own private dog food commercial. According to our father, anyone could tell that the two of them were in love. Late one January evening, while lying on a blanket in the garage, Duchess gave birth to a litter of slick, potato-sized puppies. When it looked as though one of them had died, our mother placed the creature in a casserole dish and popped it into the oven, like the witch in Hansel and Gretel. "Oh, keep your shirts on," she said. "It's only set on 150. I'm not baking anyone. This is just to keep it warm." The heat revived the sick puppy and left us believing that our mother was capable of resurrecting the dead. Faced with the responsibilities of fatherhood, Rastus took off. The puppies were given away and we moved south where the heat and humidity worked against the best interests of a collie. Duchess's once beautiful coat now hung in ragged patches. When finally, full of worms, she collapsed in the ravine beside our house, we reevaluated our mother's healing powers. The entire animal kingdom was beyond her scope. She could only resurrect the cute dead. The oven trick was performed on half a dozen dazed and chubby hamsters, but failed to work on my first guinea pig, who died after eating 4 cigarettes and an entire pack of matches. "Don't take it too hard," my mother said, removing her oven mitts. "The world is full of guinea pigs. You can get another one tomorrow." Eulogies tended to be brief. Our motto being, "There's always more where this one came from." A short time after Duchess died, our father came home with a German Shepherd puppy. For reasons that were never fully explained, the privilege of naming the dog went to a friend of my older sister's, a 14-year-old girl named Cindy. She was studying German at the time, and after carefully examining the puppy and weighing it with her hands, she announced that it would be called Mädchen, which apparently meant girl in what she referred to as Deutsch. We weren't wild about the name, but considered ourselves lucky that Cindy wasn't studying one of the Asian languages. When she was 6 months old, Machen was hit and killed by a car. Her food was still in the bowl when our father brought home an identical German Shepherd, the same Cindy christened as Machen II. This tag team progression was disconcerting, especially for the new dog who was expected to possess both the knowledge and the personality of her predecessor. Machen I would never have wet on the floor like that, my father would scold, and the dog would sigh, knowing she was the canine equivalent of a rebound. Machen II never accompanied us to the beach and rarely posed in any of the family photographs. Once her puppyhood was spent, we more or less lost interest. We ought to get a dog, we'd sometimes say, completely forgetting that we already had one. She came inside to eat, but most of her time was spent out in the pen, slumped in the A-frame doghouse our father had designed and crafted from scraps of redwood. Hey, he'd ask, how many dogs can say they live in a redwood house? Leading to my mother's exhausted, oh, Lou, how many dogs can say much of anything? During the era of the Machens, we had a succession of drowsy, secretive cats who seemed to share a unique bond with our mother. It's because I open their cans, she said, though we all knew it ran deeper than that. What they had in common were their claws. That and a deep-seated need to destroy my father's golf bags. The first cat passed into a disagreeable old age and died hissing at the kitten who had prematurely arrived to replace her. When at the age of 9, the second cat was diagnosed with feline leukemia, my mother was devastated. I'm going to have Sadie put to sleep, she said. It's for her own good, and I don't want to hear a word about it from any of you. This is hard enough as it is. The cat was put down, and then came the anonymous postcards and phone calls orchestrated by my sisters and I. The cards announced a miraculous new cure for feline leukemia. While the callers identified themselves as representatives of Cat Fancy magazine, we'd like to use Sadie as our cover story. And we're hoping to schedule a photo shoot. Is tomorrow possible? We thought a kitten might lift our mother's spirits, but she declined all offers. That's it, she said. My cat days are over. When Machen II developed splenic tumors, our father dropped everything and ran to her side. Evenings were spent at the animal hospital, lying on a mat outside of her cage and adjusting her IV. He'd never afforded her much attention, but her impending death alerted in him a great sense of duty. He was holding her paw when she died, and he spent the next several weeks asking us how many dogs could say they'd lived in a redwood house. Our mother, in turn, frequently paused beside my father's tattered, urine-stained golf bag and relived memories of her own. After spending a petless year with only one child still living at home, my parents visited a breeder and returned with a Great Dane they named Melina. They loved this dog in proportion to its size, and soon their hearts had no room for anyone else. In terms of family, their 6 children had been nothing more than a failed experiment. Melina was the real thing. The house was given over to the dog, rooms redecorated to suit her fancy. Enter your former bedroom and you'd be told, you'd better not let Melina catch you in here. Or, this is where we come to watch the squirrels. Our beds were matted with fine short hairs. The knobs to our dressers whittled down to damp stumps. Scream at the mangled leather carcass lying at the foot of the stairs and my parents would roar with laughter. That's what you get for leaving your shoes on the living room floor. The dog was their first true common interest, and they loved it equally, each in their own way. Our mother's love tended towards the horizontal, a pet being little more than a napping companion, something she could look at and say, that looks like a good idea. Scoot over, why don't you? A stranger peeking through the window might think that the two of them had entered a suicide pact. She and the dog sprawled like corpses, their limbs arranged into an internal embrace. My father loved the Great Dane for its size and frequently took her on long, aimless drives during which she'd stick her heavy, anvil-sized head out the window and leak great quantities of foamy saliva. Other drivers pointed and stared, rolling down their windows to shout, "Hey, you got a saddle for that thing?" When out for a walk, there was the inevitable, "Are you walking her, or is it the other way around?" Our father always laughed as if this were the first time he'd heard it. The attention was addictive, and he enjoyed a pride of accomplishment he'd never felt with any of us. It was as if he were somehow responsible for her size and stature, as if he'd personally designed her spots and trained her to grow to the size of a pony. When out with the dog, he carried a leash in one hand and a shovel in the other. "Just in case," he said. "Just in case what? She dies and you need to bury her?" I didn't get it. "No," he'd say, it's for her business." My father was retired, but the dog had business. I was living in Chicago when they first got Melina, and every time I came home, the animal was bigger. Every time, there were more Marmaduke cartoons displayed upon the refrigerator. And every time, my voice grew louder as I asked myself, "Who are these people?" "Down, girl," my parents would chuckle as the puppy jumped up, panting for my attention. Her great padded paws reached my waist, then my chest and shoulders, until eventually, her arms wrapped around my neck and her head towering above my own, she came to resemble a dance partner scouting the room for a better offer. "That's just her way of saying hello," my mother would say, handing me the towel used to wipe up the dog's bubbling seepage. "Here, you missed a spot on the back of your head." Amongst us children, Melina's diploma from obedience school was seen as the biggest joke since our brother's graduation from Sanderson High. "So she's not book smart," our mother said. "Big deal, I can fetch my own paper." The dog's growth was monitored on a daily basis, and every small accomplishment was documented for later generations. One can find few pictures of my sister Tiffany, while Melina has entire volumes devoted to her terrible twos. "Hit me," my mother said on one of my returns home from Chicago. "No, wait, let me go get my camera." She left the room and returned a few moments later. "Okay," she said, "now hit me. Better yet, why don't you just pretend to hit me?" I raised my hand and my mother cried out in pain. "Ow," she yelled, "somebody help me. This stranger is trying to hurt me and I don't know why." I caught an advancing blur moving in from the left. And the next thing I knew, I was down on the ground. The Great Dane tearing holes in the neck of my sweater. The camera flashed and my mother squealed with delight. "God, I love that trick." I rolled over to protect my face. "This isn't a trick." My mother snapped another picture. "Oh, don't be so critical. It's close enough." With us grown and out of the house, my sisters and I foolishly expected our parents' lives to stand still. They were supposed to stagnate and live in the past, but instead they constructed a new we, consisting of Melina and the founding members of her fan club. Someone who obviously didn't know her too well had given my mother a cheerful stuffed bear with a calico heart stitched onto its chest. According to the manufacturer, the bear's name was Mumbles, and all it needed in order to thrive were 2 AA batteries and a regular diet of hugs. "Where's Mumbles?" my mother would ask, and the dog would jump up and snatch the bear from its hiding place on top of the refrigerator, yanking it this way and that in hopes of breaking its neck. Occasionally, her teeth would press against the on switch, and the doomed thing would flail its arms, whispering one of its 5 pre-recorded messages of goodwill. "That's my girl," my mother would say. "We don't like Mumbles, do we?" I learned that we liked Morley Safer, but not Mike Wallace. That we didn't like Mumbles or Thunder, but were crazy about Stan Getz Records and the Iranian couple who'd moved in up the street. It was difficult to keep straight, but having known these people all my life, I didn't want to be left out of the we.